Hello and welcome to the Loopcast. Today I'm very happy to have Dr. Jonathan Schroden, and he is the director of the Center for Stability and Development at the CNA Corporation. And just for those who do not know about CNA, CNA is a corporation and it's nonprofit and it does research and analysis, and it's located here in Alexandria, Virginia. And I'm very happy to have you on the line, Mr. Dr. Schroden. So thank you for coming on the Loopcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And today we're going to be talking about an independent assessment of the Afghan National Security Forces that CNA has just released this report recently, which we will provide a link to the report with this talk. But I'm very excited to talk about this. And the report looks at the Afghan environment for 2015 through 2018, so post-U.S. drawback and international force drawback, should I say. So I'd love to talk about a basic overview of the study. The study was done to assess the Afghan National Security Forces' capability to provide security for their own country post-U.S. drawback and international forces drawback. So, Dr. Schroden, could you please give us a background for the report and maybe talk about the methodology and some of the key findings within the report?
Sure. I'll do my best to keep it as pithy as I can. It's a very long report, as we were discussing earlier. The genesis of this report came from the U.S. Congress. In last year's National Defense Authorization Act, they passed some language that mandated the Secretary of Defense to provide for the conduct of an independent assessment of the Afghan National Security Forces. And it specified that the congressional language specified a few things that were kind of interesting. One is it specified some specific things that the study should look at, and I'll talk about what those are in just a minute. But it also it basically said that the Department of Defense should hire an external entity, and it specified that a likely entity would be a federally funded research and development center, or an FFRDC, which is what the CNA Corporation is. So it specified that type of organization, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, should do this assessment. And it also specified that the assessment should be unclassified, which kind of implies that it would be releasable to the public, and that the assessment should ultimately go to the U.S. Congress. And so it's a fairly unique requirement that the Congress put on the Department of Defense in that regard. My understanding is typically when the Congress asks DOD to conduct these types of studies, they don't specify that they need to be releasable, and they often don't specify that they even need to go to Congress. A lot of times they'll task DOD to do a study and sort of be satisfied that the issue that they were concerned about was looked at. So this one was obviously of greater importance to them because they wanted it reported directly back to them. The study itself, in terms of the tasks that we were asked to look at, four of them were specified in the congressional language explicitly, and those, just real quickly, the first task was to do an independent threat assessment, so looking forward over the next decade in Afghanistan to identify what we thought the future threat to the Afghan government and to the security of Afghanistan would be, and then the second was to then basically analyze what the force strength structure, posture, so you know, location and laydown, and capabilities that would be required for the Afghan National Security Forces to have in order to counter the threat that we identified in the first task. And then the third and fourth tasks really were to look at what capabilities and capability gaps the ANSF would have going forward, most notably after 2014, and what resources would be needed in order to mitigate those gaps such that they would be able to provide security for their own country. So those were the tasks that Congress levied upon the DOD, which were then passed to us. In addition, the Department of Defense asked us to look at a few additional things as part of the study. They asked us to look at the ministries of Interior and Defense, so the security ministries in Afghanistan, to look at their current capabilities and whether or not they would be independently able to provide the support to the forces in the field that would be required to to basically support them going forward. And if not, if they were not independent by the end of this year, then what capability gaps would remain in the MOD and MOI, and how could we best mitigate that? What, via an advisor mission or some other mitigating capabilities. They also asked us to look at, what legal authorities would be required for U.S. forces to operate in Afghanistan in a post-2014 environment. So the current mandate under which we operate in Afghanistan, the set of agreements that we have will expire at the end of this year, and so that's why there's a lot of news about the U.S. pursuing a bilateral security agreement with Afghanistan. That is one set of authorities that we would need to operate in Afghanistan in 2015 and beyond, but they asked us to look more detailed at what other authorities might be required. They also asked us to look at what was termed sort of opportunities for cooperation or at least prevention of conflict between the ANSF and the Pakistani military, especially along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. As you can imagine, that's a very important stretch of land, one that the Afghans don't actually recognize, but trying to understand whether there was ways that the two nation security forces could better cooperate along that border to issues that they have there. And then the last task was to look at some likely or at least possible future political scenarios and how the ANSF might respond if those scenarios were to come to pass. So that's kind of an overview of the study. Obviously, that's a lot of work. It was a tremendous amount of work, and we had about 3.5 months to get it done. So as you can imagine, we had quite a large team of very, very senior and expert folks that worked on this to get all of those tasks accomplished in about 3.5 months.
Very much so. And that was actually a question I was going to ask, how long it took to get this assessment completed. So you answered the question. Could you describe for us the political and strategic rationale of building the Afghan National Security Forces?
Sure. So, like any country you need a base level security force to provide security and civil order for the citizens of that country, right? So at the base level, you would need an Afghan National Security Forces, which just for the sake of those who aren't familiar with the ANSF, includes police forces, army forces, air forces, as well as special operations forces. You need those forces in order to provide just a base level of security. Now, obviously, in Afghanistan, you have an insurgency that is a lot stronger in some places, some parts of the country than others. And so the way in which those security forces are laid down and also the capabilities that they have varies geographically across the country. And so that was something that we looked at as part of the study as well, in terms of what capabilities forces would need. And how those forces and capabilities should be arrayed. In terms of I realize I didn't really answer your earlier question about methodology, but it kind of comes into this question as well. We looked very closely at what the insurgents did in Afghanistan historically. So we looked at three historical case studies, those being what the Mujahideen did against the Soviets, both during the Soviet presence and in the wake of their withdrawal. We looked at the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in the mid-90s, and then we looked at the Taliban resurgence of capability in the 2006 to 2009 timeframe in Afghanistan to understand at sort of tactical to strategic levels, how did they go about trying to take over the country? What tactics did they use? What types of operational campaigns did they engage in? What areas did they go after? In what order? Which gives you a sense of how they prioritize various parts of the country as well. And so using those historical case studies along with an analysis of current intelligence estimates, and we were fortunate enough to be able to meet with a large number of Afghans while we were in Afghanistan and were able to get their intelligence assessments as well, we were able to identify basically to prioritize regions of the country by a set of what we called security tiers. And without going into those at length, because we discussed them quite a bit in the report, but basically these are prioritized areas of Afghanistan relative to strategic importance and also threat from the insurgency. So these are areas that the insurgents would want to try and get a hold of. And that's kind of a roundabout way of answering your question, which is to say there are certain areas in Afghanistan, right, that are more important at strategic political levels, and those tend to be the populated areas, as you can imagine, right? So both in addition to defending the political structure, i.e. the government in Afghanistan, those areas are more important. But also when it comes to securing the bulk of Afghans, those areas are the most important because that's where the vast majority of the population in Afghanistan actually lives. So that's really, you know, that's kind of the methodology and the template that we were using to design the ANSF, which is also why you need that force in the first place, right? To protect the political structure of the country and also the people who live within that political structure.
Very much so. And looking at the political context, what was the political role in developing the ANSF?
Do you mean on the part of the U.S. and NATO or on the part of the Afghan government?
Both, if possible.
Sure. So the development of the ANSF has actually been a bit of a long and winding road. In the aftermath of the invasion in 2001, when we pushed the Taliban out and a new government was put in place, there was a plan that was established to rebuild the Afghan army and the Afghan police force in order to provide what at that time was envisioned as just a base level security force to provide civil order across the country. Mm-hmm. And the various pillars of the force, so the police, the army, et cetera, were given over to various allied countries within NATO to develop. So if I recall correctly, the Germans were given the mission of growing the police, the Italians were given the mission of growing the justice sector, and the U.S. was given the mission of growing the army. And over time, it became clear that those efforts were insufficient in a number of ways. And so there were a number of developments that I won't run through the long history of, but eventually led to a series of decisions in about the 2008 timeframe to focus on building a much larger Afghan police force and Afghan army, as well as air forces and special operations forces. And the U.S. assumed a much greater role in training aspects of the ANSF other than the army. And so there was training commands that were stood up in Afghanistan and a lot more resources in terms of manpower and money and effort and focus was put on building the ANSF. And a political decision was made at that time to focus first on building the numbers of the Afghan National Security Forces. So trying to rapidly recruit and train large numbers of people to get them out into the field in order to basically stem what was a rising Taliban insurgency. So the Taliban was gaining in strength over those years, and so they needed to rapidly field a security force, an indigenous security force, to try and blunt that rise. And so for a number of years, in fact, up until about last year, so 2008 through 2012, the emphasis really was on growing the number of Afghan security forces, not so much on professionalizing them or providing them with the capabilities that would allow them to be independently sustainable. Now, about a year ago, a year and a half ago, they started to get to the point where they had grown the forces to very near their end strength caps, so to within about 85 to 90% of what they were ultimately going to be sized at. And so at that point, a decision was made to sort of shift focus from this rapid growth emphasis to an emphasis on creating capabilities to sustain the force. So logistics, artillery, the Air Force, personnel management systems, warehousing, distribution, contracting, oversight, all these sort of additional capabilities that security forces need in order to sustain themselves independently. And so there's been a much, much greater push over the last year and a half to develop those types of capabilities. And when we looked at the forces, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself because I realized I didn't fully answer your question earlier as to what the findings of the study were, so I can come back to that. But when we looked at the capabilities of the ANSF after 2014, what we determined is that really, and because of that decision, there are going to be a number of capability gaps that still remain in the ANSF, right? And so these will be things like mobility, things like air support, things like ability to oversee contracts, logistics. I mean, all of these sort of support functions that a professional Army and police force need to be able to do in order to ensure that they can continue to operate in the field and sustain themselves, the ANSF are just not going to be able to do the bulk of that independently by the end of this year. So that's one of our conclusions, was that an advisor presence as well as some enabler capabilities, most notably things like Air Force, air support, and some logistics support, are going to be required in Afghanistan for a number of years in the future, in our estimation, through at least 2018.
Right. And I know that in the report you identify these critical capability gaps, and you kind of point out six different areas which you've touched bases on already. And they left me to have this question in my head: is the ANSF really a military if they can't basically do the things listed in your capability gaps, like these six areas? They're very important, as you were saying. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. We have another report that I think we're going to be releasing in the next few days, which is a much shorter piece that basically looks back on the totality of last year and answers the question of, were the ANSF successful in their fight against the Taliban last year, and kind of where do they stand now? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is, at tactical levels, the Afghan National Security Forces are actually quite capable. And we observe them firsthand in the field. And I think this is actually a fairly resonant narrative amongst people who have been following Afghanistan and the ANSF for some time, and that they are actually very effective fighters on the ground. When they get into tactical firefights with the Taliban, they generally hold their own and perform very well in those situations. So at the tactical level, where people are, no kidding, shooting at each other, they tend to do very well. Where they tend to be less effective is in mounting large operations that require detailed, deliberate planning in advance, that require significant coordination across the various components of the ANSF, so, police coordinating with the Army, coordinating with the Air Force, et cetera, and then being able to sustain those types of operations for more than a couple of days. That's really where we've been helping them for the last year or so, is at that operational level. But at the tactical level, in terms of, standing on checkpoints or, manning small bases, generally speaking, and there have been some exceptions to this, obviously, but generally speaking, they are very effective at that tactical level.
And speaking of the operational level, has the ANSF, have they shown any goals? Like, what are their operational goals?
Yeah, I mean, I think their operational goals, largely stem from the political goals, the goals of their political masters, if you will. So, first and foremost is defense of Afghan civilians, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they are a security force, and so they are there to provide security to the population in support of the stability of the country, and the political stability is a piece of that. But in addition to that, I mean, they have been fighting a Taliban insurgent, a Taliban-led insurgency for the last, 12, 13, I guess 13 years now that we've been there. But even before that, right? They've literally been fighting these guys for decades. And so I think there's a vested interest in a lot of their parts in just seeing some kind of peaceful resolution to the ongoing violence in Afghanistan. And so, these guys are fighting for not just the security of the areas in which they live and in which their families live, but quite literally for the preservation of the country that they've come to know over the last decade. And, it's a really interesting, I think, point to make in that the Afghanistan of today is a very, very different country than the Afghanistan that the Taliban were in charge of 13 years ago. 13 years in a country where the average life expectancy is on the order of 45 to 50 years is almost a generation of people. And so you have this, class of Taliban leader or fighter who has spent the last decade or more living in Pakistan outside of the country. Meanwhile, you've had this generation of young Afghans who have grown up knowing a different situation, knowing something other than Taliban rule, being able to go to schools, being able to use cell phones and the internet and, see things on TV. It's just a very, very different country now than it was 13 years ago. And I think that's a really underappreciated point when people talk about the future of Afghanistan.
And so, I mean, those who have been following the news on Afghanistan, it seems like in the last couple of months there's been, I don't know if it'd be the right way of explaining it, but an increased wave in Taliban attacks, especially in Kabul, or Taliban associated attacks, we could call it that. How do you see the ANSF solving or mitigating these types of issues and working through this sort of new era that's opening up in Afghanistan?
Yeah, so I mean it's a combination of a few things. The Taliban and the other groups that fight with them know that international forces are drawing down. They know that this is a very precarious year for Afghanistan with the presidential election about to take place in a few months. And so they're doing what they can to make a statement to try and sort of prove to people that they're still relevant, that they still have capability. And they're trying to convince people that when the international forces leave, that they will come storming back. And that's always been, the information space has always been kind of the forefront of the Taliban's insurgency. I mean, they do events in support of being able to say things in the information space to try and convince people one way or the other. Now, our study, when we looked forward at the next, 5 to 10 years in Afghanistan, looking at the threat, we concluded that the Taliban actually are likely to gain in strength during that time frame, especially over the next 5 years, and that's largely as a result of the drawdown of international forces. I mean, as you can expect, we had upwards of 100,000 troops on the ground there within the last couple of years. I think right now the total is somewhere around 50,000, but drawing down very quickly to the 30,000s. And by the end of this year, depending on how things go with the bilateral security agreement and what decisions are made within the White House and within the halls of NATO, you could have a force of 10,000 or some number less than that internationally in Afghanistan as well. And so the drawdown of the number of international forces by a factor of 10 or more reduces pressure on the insurgency. And so that reduction of pressure, combined with the fact that they continue to maintain a sanctuary in Pakistan, in which they're largely untouched by Pakistani security forces, will allow them to regenerate capability and to push that capability back into Afghanistan. And again, looking at the historical case studies that we analyzed, there's every reason to believe that they will both regenerate capability and seek to push that capability in Afghanistan. So for the next few years, I wouldn't be surprised at all if we continue to see levels of violence and levels of attacks within Afghanistan, not unlike what we've seen last year or this year. But I think it's important to note or to point out that that doesn't necessarily mean the ANSF are losing or that the country is somehow falling apart. The ANSF are a force that is very much still growing in capability, in competency. And I think our findings were that if we maintain a presence there, if we continue to advise and enable the ANSF, that our belief was that there is every likelihood that they can continue to hold against the Taliban insurgency. Not, it's a key distinction, not to militarily defeat them. And in fact, in our estimation, so long as the Taliban have a safe sanctuary in Pakistan where they can regenerate capability and project it back in Afghanistan, their military defeat, the military defeat of the Taliban is highly unlikely. But if the if the ANSF can sort of blunt what is likely to be a Taliban offensive in the next, you know, 3 or 4 years and show that they're capable of standing and holding and warding off this Taliban insurgency largely on their own, our estimation is that that greatly increases the chances for and likelihood of a negotiated political settlement to the conflict in the 2019 to 2023 timeframe. So it's important to note that the levels of violence that we see in Afghanistan are, I think, not likely to decline significantly, but as long as they're not escalating significantly either, that the situation there may still be manageable by the ANSF for the next, you know, 5 years or so.
And what is the ANSF's involvement with the drug trade in Afghanistan? So in the sense of monitoring that, cracking down on it and so forth, do they have a hand in that?
I think it depends on sort of where, you know, where you look and who you talk to. We didn't look at the counter-narcotics issue explicitly within this study because it was somewhat outside the mandate of what we were asked to look at. And frankly, it's a hugely complicating factor. And I'll just admit that we didn't have the time or resources to look into that to the extent that we would have wanted to, even had our mandate included that. Again, depending on who you talk to and sort of which reports you read, the assessments are, you know, that they're sort of, you know, possibly tacitly involved in that they allow it to, you know, drug smuggling and growing of poppy and that type of thing to occur and don't really do anything about it up to the level of being, you know, actually involved in the drug trade.
Right.
It's difficult for me to comment on the extent of that because we didn't really look at that point in detail as part of the study.
Oh, that's fine. It just sort of popped into my head knowing the geographics of Afghanistan, so I thought I'd shoot that one out to you. Talking about the Afghan National Army and then the Afghan National Police, where do we place the relationship between these two entities, so the police and the army, in comparison to the Afghan National Security Forces?
Yeah, so the police and the army, I think it's a good question because they, I think when Westerners or, you know, Americans think about police and army, we tend to think about the police and army that we know. And the Afghan police especially are not like the police that we know and sort of understand. And in fact, when we looked at to expand on that point a bit more, they don't do things that we would expect police to do, such as, you know, patrol beats, arrest people, build case files to then take people to trial, you know, have trials in court of law and incarcerate people who are found, who are convicted and found guilty. That's not really how the Afghan police and Afghan security or justice system works. It's a lot more rudimentary than that, and frankly, a lot more tribally based. And so the police force that they have is largely one that they do a lot of standing at checkpoints. They are largely an area security force. And the army, to to a lesser extent, but still, they do a lot of that too. And so that was one of the findings in our report, was that the practical distinction between the police and the Army on the ground at the tactical level is oftentimes not really that great in terms of what it is they're actually doing. A lot of these guys are simply standing at checkpoints on roads or in cities, basically just watching who goes where, making sure that people who are not supposed to be going places don't get there, and basically serving as a means of denying freedom of movement and action to the insurgency. And so there's, at sort of that level, there's not a huge amount of difference at the tactical level in many respects from what a lot of the police and what a lot of the Army are doing. Now, the training that they get is very different. The Army actually gets significantly better and more advanced training than the police do. So in terms of the capabilities and the training they have, there is a significant difference between the two. But, you know, sort of practically speaking at the tactical level, a lot of what they do is stand at checkpoints. Mm.
And in the report, you point out that the ANSF would be more successful with fewer infantry units and more support units. Could you explain why this is the case?
Yeah, so, you know, one of our, let me back up a little bit, and I'll sort of set the context for that by talking a little bit about the results in terms of the size of the force. So what we did was to, using that threat assessment that I talked about, we then tied it via the methodology of the security tiers that I mentioned earlier to a quantitative, what's called a truth-to-task analysis. And so we looked at the actual missions or tasks that the police, the Army, Special Forces, and the Air Force would need to conduct. And then we sized those forces to conduct those tasks. And when we did that, we arrived at a conclusion that the ANSF should probably be sized somewhere in the vicinity of 373,000 total forces for at least the next 5 years. And that's slightly less than the current size of the ANSF, which is 382,000. And that sounds like a bit of a non-finding on its face, but it's actually fairly significant because the current plan that NATO has in place is to draw the ANSF down to an end strength of 228,500, so to cut them by 150,000 troops or so by 2017 or 2018. So our recommendation was that that's really not a sound policy option given our goals in Afghanistan, and that they should revisit that and probably keep the ANSF at a much larger force size through at least 2018. Mm-hmm. Now, within that force size, we made some additional recommendations to help them be more effective in the field. And one of those recommendations is what you just hinted at, which is when we looked at the Army, we concluded that they could actually accomplish the operational goals in Afghanistan that they would have with fewer combat forces than what they have now. Now, that sounds a little funny on its face, given that I said earlier that the Taliban insurgency is likely to grow in strength. But we also, so on the police side, we made a number of recommendations that sort of changed their capabilities as well. So you have to understand this is a bit of a holistic discussion that we, or analysis that we did across all of the security forces. But taking the Army specifically, we thought they could get by with fewer combat battalions. I think we recommended a reduction of about 11 combat battalions. But that force structure savings would need to be reinvested into the Army in the form of support forces. So both logistics forces, you know, all the capability gaps that I talked about earlier, artillery, all that kind of stuff. We thought that the reduction in combat forces should be reinvested in the support side in order to make them a more sustainable Army. Because when you look at their ratios of, ratios of fighting forces to support forces, they're actually extremely lean by any sort of modern Army standards. And so in order to sustain themselves over the long haul, they're going to need a significantly larger support force. And ultimately, being able to do that gives them more combat power because they can sustain that combat power in the field. So even though, overall it's a smaller number of battalions, their combat power would ultimately increase by making the recommendation or following the recommendation that we made.
Right, and this quoting of this figure of 373,000 personnel forces, we could put it that way as well. My question is, how will the government of Afghanistan post-US involvement pay for and sustain these forces in both size and terms and political will? Because I mean, I think you quote a number of about it's going to cost them about $5 to $6 billion per year to sustain this modern force. I mean, how do you think Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, is going to be able to provide funds for such big funds for this?
Yeah, well, I mean, the bottom line is Afghanistan will be reliant upon the international community for the bulk of the money needed to pay for the ANSF for the foreseeable future. The current plan that NATO had in place, which involved a force of about 228,000, as I said, estimated the cost of that force at about $4 billion per year. Now, the cost-sharing agreement that was sort of put in place at the NATO summit in Chicago in 2012 was that the Afghan government would pay for about a $500,000 of that per year. The international community would be expected to kick in about another $1.5 billion, and the U.S. would pick up the rest. So, a tally of about $2 billion a year for the U.S. That, of course, was for a force of about 228,000. Now, we recommended that the ANSF should stay at a size of about 373,000. We made some very rough order of magnitude cost estimates for that force, and those fell in the range of $5 to $6 billion per year, which is significantly higher than the $4 billion per year that was looked at for the 228,000 size force. How much of that could Afghanistan be expected to pay? Well, they were expected to kick in $500 million for the forces currently planned. Obviously, that's a long ways from being able to pay for all of it, but there are some things that, and we don't necessarily make these recommendations in the report, but if you look at Afghanistan's revenue streams, there are some things that they could do to try and increase the amount of revenue that they have available to apply against the ANSF and, frankly, for other development projects within the country. The two biggest things they could do would be to, sort of rein in the level of corruption overall within the government, which is, of course, easier said than done. But nonetheless, if they were able to do that, it would significantly enhance the amount of revenue that the country has. And the second thing, which is tied directly to that, is to better enforce the and reduce corruption when it comes to collecting customs dues at their borders. One of the major lines of revenue for Afghanistan comes in the form of dues collections at the borders. Afghanistan sits in a strategically important location within South Asia when it comes to the transport of goods and natural resources, both from Central Asia south to the Indian Ocean, but also east and west. A lot of goods travel back and forth through Afghanistan on their way to other places. And they collect a lot of dues, basically to allow those things to transit their country. But a lot of that money is siphoned off by corrupt actors or is just not effectively collected. And so if they really emphasized that aspect of their revenue stream, they could generate more money if they really wanted to exert the political will to do that. But the bottom line question or answer to your question is, they will not be able to pay for their security forces, even at the level that NATO was currently planning, the 228,000, for the foreseeable future. They just don't have the revenue streams to do that. And so they're going to be reliant on the international community to pay for the bulk of their security force, really almost no matter what size that force is.
So, if there's this expectation that the international community is going to provide the funds and advisors, at what length can we expect this commitment to last?
Yeah, and that's a great question. When we looked at it, I think our conclusion was through at least 2018, those advisors and that level of funding would be required. Of course, at that time, you would probably want to, or at least along the way, you would probably want to reassess how much longer the advisor presence would be needed and how much longer you would need to maintain an ANSF at 373,000 forces. It could be a long period of time. It could be a relatively shorter period of time, depending on how effective they are in the field and whether or not the Taliban insurgency eventually decides that it's had enough in terms of fighting a force that is effectively combating them, assuming that that's what happens. I don't have a good answer in terms of, ultimately for how long would you need to do this. I think our estimation was for at least the next 5 years that level of support would be required. But I think it's an important point, and this was, pointed out to us by a number of folks that we spoke with as part of the study, that you really have to look at that cost in a comparative sense. So, for me or you or the average taxpayer, $5 to $6 billion a year sounds like an awful lot of money, and certainly it is. But when you look at the relative cost to paying $5 to $6 billion per year to have the ANSF fighting this insurgency, which includes elements of Al-Qaeda, and really managing that problem on our behalf, that is a lot cheaper than having 100,000 U.S. and NATO forces on the ground, which was costing us upwards of $100 billion every year. And it's certainly less expensive than, having a repeat of 9/11, for example. So, how far you want to take that cost comparative discussion is sort of up to the listener here. But certainly having, a $5 to $6 billion ANSF that is managing the security problem in Afghanistan, and again, which includes elements of Al-Qaeda, on our behalf is a lot cheaper than us doing it ourselves.
Very much so. Before concluding, I have one more question. And what it is how would you address the critics that argue that this funding development model exacerbates Afghanistan's economic dependence on outsiders?
It's a situation where they are a country, again, that is so poor at this point that they are wholly reliant on the international community for a lot of things, and their security is one of those things. There's no real way around that, at least not for the next probably 5 to 10 years, as they continue to develop their streams of revenue, such as the various natural resources that they have, minerals, and they do have some oil resources, that kind of thing. But those will take some time to get up and running. And until that time, they are going to be reliant on the international community. So, there's a choice of we can say we're not going to support them. And we've sort of seen what happens in Afghanistan when the international community does that, and it's pretty much bad for everybody. Or they can say, we are going to support you in the ways that you need in order to sort of develop to the level that you can be an independently sustainable country. But I think the point that you might be driving at is the way in which you do that is critical, right? And having proper oversight of our funds, ensuring that the funds are going to what their intended purpose was, that they don't get skimmed off by actors along the way, and that we just maintain accountability of where those funds go and what they're being used for, is extremely important. And I think that that's another reason that you would want to have some level of, advisory presence on the ground in Afghanistan, because that keeps your eyes and ears on the ground, at least to some extent, to allow you to have a better sense of, is the money that's being provided to support the ANSF going where it's supposed to go and being used what it's supposed to be used for? That's not going to be, those advisors will be doing lots of other things, and so you can't rely on them to be doing that all the time. But not having them there basically creates an information void, as opposed to having them there and being able to at least have some eyes and ears as to, is the assistance that we're providing being used for what it's supposed to be used for?
Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. We like to give our guests an opportunity to touch on something that maybe perhaps we haven't touched on in the discussion. So I'll give the floor over to you, if there's anything that you think is worthy of mentioning.
I'll just point out real quickly that, you know, in the additional tasks that we were asked to do without running through them all, we did look at the ministries as well. For those who are interested in security sector reform and those types of topics, we looked very closely at the Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Interior, and the report talks about what capabilities those structures would need to have in order to effectively support the forces that are in the field. I mean, that's a really important aspect of the security system within Afghanistan in terms of being holistically effective. And that's really a neglected part of the discussion when it comes to the NSF. People tend to get hung up on, you know, numbers and cost, and to some extent rightfully so. But when you dive a layer deeper, I think it's really important to consider all the aspects of the security forces there. And so if people are interested in sort of where the Ministry of Defense and Interior are within Afghanistan in terms of capabilities they have and capabilities they need, we do, I think, a pretty good job of analyzing that within the report as well.
Very much so. And like I said, for our listeners, we will post the link to CNA's report so that you can read it yourself. And thank you for coming on the show, Dr. Schroden.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
And for those that don't know about CNA Corporation, I highly recommend going to the website because they have a lot of fantastic analysis on not just Afghanistan, but topic areas around the world and other issues that are quite important. So please check out CNA's website. And once again, thank you for coming on the show and have a fantastic afternoon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. You too.